You're listening to a special edition of The Briefing on Monocle Radio, recorded live at the Sustainable Cities in Action Forum 2024 at Expo City Dubai on the 5th of March.
A warm welcome to our show, The Briefing, coming to you from the Nexus here at Expo City Dubai. I'm Tom Edwards. This is the first of our series of special programmes. We're training Monocle's lens on some of the critical themes at the Sustainable Cities in Action Forum 2024. This first broadcast has some very special guests, some of whom are assembled already. We're going to be talking about the role of urban design in the face of so many varied challenges, some of which we've heard about. We have a great selection of guests to do this job for us. Let me welcome back to the stage Charles Landry, an international authority on the use of imagination and creativity in driving urban change. You'll probably know Charles from the Creative City concept, amongst plenty of others. Also with us, we have Jonathan Ashmore, who is here he comes. Here's Jonathan, principal of an architect studio, the award-winning London and Dubai-based architecture and design practice founded in 2013. And also still on the stage, we have Sophia Schiff, of course, from GALE, director there, an urban anthropologist and team lead at GALE's Copenhagen studio. A warm welcome to all of them. And I should say, we want this to be very participatory. So in the course of our proceedings, if you want to ask a question, don't wait for the end. Get your hand up and I'll come roaming out to get you involved in the programme. Still with us, Monocle's editor-in-chief, Andrew Tuck. And I guess, Andrew, fresh from a number of busy sessions, you're working hard. I've got a thing here about keeping things agile. You've demonstrated a fair bit of agility already. But let's take a step back. Why exactly are Monocle here? And what are some of the values in this space which we espouse?
Well, I hope as journalists we're as good as listening as asking the questions. And I think that's the important thing for us. We're here, this podcast goes out to tens of thousands of people around the world. It goes out as a live radio show on Monocle as well. But also the stories that we have here will come to life in the magazine. And it's a privilege for us always to be in the room with these conversations. When we first started Monocle, we felt that there was a huge amount of conversations going on in city halls, in these kinds of events, which sometimes were shrouded in a certain kind of speak about planning and design that alienated some people. I think that's changed a lot over time. People want their voices to be heard. Oddly, the pandemic was good for that. People felt that they wanted to have a say in how their cities were run and how they changed and evolved over time. So Tom, that's why we're here. I'm excited about this conversation being amplified. It's always great when you have hundreds of people together in a room making decisions, but it's only when it gets amplified outside of that room that it really begins its journey, I think.
Well, hopefully, Andrew, everyone will jump in across some of our themes, but I wanted to just start off by talking about one thing, which I think picks up on a number of the panels we've heard from already this morning earlier, which is about, we're talking about placemaking, but I think implicit in that is this idea of belonging somewhere. And Charles, if I can come to you just first of all, when we talk about what belonging means in the context of urban spaces, do we all understand, again, we talked at this point about metrics, what we mean and how we qualify that almost impossible to describe feeling of belonging in a certain place?
What's quite interesting, you just used the word placemaking. What's been really a big thing, and you obviously all know this, is the shift in the conversation from urban development and urban planning to placemaking, which in itself is a completely different form of discipline because it implies thinking together in an integrated way. And when you then have the different insights, anthropological and whatever else, together, you're beginning to get a more rounded view of what a great place is. And if I were to simplify, I'm a simplifier, I would say the difference between space and place is place is space imbued, embedded with meaning. And when that happens, you perhaps have these little anchor points of I am here, I like being here, which is another way of saying I belong, perhaps.
Sophia, I know I mentioned placemaking earlier, and there was an arched eyebrow from you. Tell me a bit about why was that your response when I used that phrase?
Well, you know, we hear the term placemaking quite often, and I think it's one of those words that can become quite diluted. And I actually love what you're saying here, Charles, about creating a sense of belonging, which makes a place out of a space. And we've been working for some time on some placemaking initiatives where we like to think of it as a way to activate a space and understand if we can really create a sense of identity, a sense of, you know, community cohesion and belonging out of some of these underused places in our cities. One project such as this that we've actually been doing in Copenhagen is a research project with a couple fantastic PhD students at Gale who did a project around working with different minority groups in Copenhagen and trying to understand where they come together in understanding a sense of belonging and really how they feel accepted and included in the public realm and where they feel excluded. And if we can find signifiers that show where people come together, where there's commonality in what creates a sense of belonging and a place, or where it is just very unique to a certain population group, and how can we start to create those stories and use those stories to infuse the kind of urban planning process that we use?
Yeah. Sophia, I just want to jump in, because Sophia said something to me I thought was really fascinating earlier. You said, before you begin in any of these processes, you just have to park your prejudices. You have to start from a bit of a ground zero. So the what's going to help a community in Copenhagen may be different to what's going to help a community in this region. If you're a planner or you're an architect company that's not doing what you're doing, how do you ever end up with a good conclusion in a way? Because you need that anthropology, don't you?
Well, yes, I would say so. It helps. I think useful tool to uncover those stories and wipe away the bias before we get into the planning process is first to just uncover what is there and make visible the invisible through observing the lived experience of people, through talking to people and kind of creating those stories about that lived experience and using those stories to then inform the planning process, which becomes a very technical thing, right?
Yeah. Jonathan, let me bring you in here, Jonathan Ashmore. It's interesting, we've had a lot of conversations that have painted this picture, which is highly complex and involves lots of big macro level thinking. And interestingly, in your practice, we're dealing more with the micro, aren't we? But I think it's really important to underscore that there's still the same opportunity to generate value, whether that's the sense of belonging or value in a project, sustainable projects, simply through the practice of good design. And you said to me earlier that some of this stuff can be done intuitively. Tell me a little bit about how these themes inform your design and architecture practice.
It's been interesting, actually. We've been in the UAE, I've been in Percy here for 15 years, and I set up our architecture practice here after relocating from London 10 years ago. And I think what we found ourselves is in the metropolis, a very modern, very quick, fast-paced moving city that's evolving very quickly. And you start to draw on what you instinctively feel and know. If there's so much information around you, you start to dig deeper into what is the fundamentals. And for us, you know, a lot of it is actually common sense. And when we talk about placemaking and what we're talking about creating authenticity, you really have to go back to the roots. And as what Andrew was saying, what you'd mentioned before about what works in one city doesn't work in another. And actually what works in one community in a city doesn't work in another city. It has to be really thought through and really researched. And what's been a really interesting side from our side is the practice, we're architecture and interior, but we do look at it from a more holistic point of view. And with those two disciplines, it has to be holistic, which then has to connect to the wider city. We've always been interested in really finding those grassroots of where they come from. You know, from the orientation to the density of the material, the locality of the material. So out of Dubai, we've been working in Africa, we've been working in the region around here and et cetera. We've adapted what we call a global local approach. I mean, I'm English, I came from the UK, I was studied in there and relocated here. So I had to use my knowledge and think about it as a practice and evolve the practice so that our responsibility when engaging in southern for Sri Lanka, for an example, on the South Coast community, an ex sort of tsunami damaged place, I have a responsibility to bring new ideas, but I have also an equal opportunity and a responsibility to draw from that. So for example, when we were working with local craftsmen from that region, it made more sense to be working with builders from the Southern Promise, not even Southern Promise myself, sorry, not Colombo, but utilizing their skills, but pushing them an extra 15%. Because what you then do with them, they take to their next project. And then also, we spoke about in the previous panel, ownership, this sense of pride in a very small fishing community that's becoming a tourist destination. Well, there's a sense of pride. And what we found is that it was really encouraging to see this response, and then it sort of becomes a small catalyst. So within architecture, it's obviously on a more micro scale, like you said, in the overall planning, you can come from the other end. You can kind of try to put infill or small projects that become catalysts on a very domestic scale that meet the planning strategic coming down from the other way, so that it's not just top coming down, I feel.
Charles, well, it's interesting, this on this idea of driving catalytic change.
I just wanted to pick up on that, that point about what you'd said and what you've just said here. I think, obviously, you're right, we need to go deep into the culture and all of that, and I, you know, of course, I agree with that. But also the interesting question, what is similar and what is the same through cultures and through time? And there are a few things that are the same. Their expression and manifestation might be different, but one of them is I do quite like to connect. Perhaps, you know, I've even touched both of you. Yeah. You know, that's just an example.
We are social animals.
Yeah, exactly. I didn't want to use that word. I'm trying to avoid all the basic words. But I'm just using that as one example. The other thing that people tend to like through close observation is chance encounter. But within that, they often want a series of things where you're balancing. We said safety, and you were saying, yeah, it's only safety. But you want a sense of feeling okay, but also the surprise. So there are a whole series of things that you, as what you do, and you, what you, as you do, you then manifest in various ways, and often that happens in gathering places and so on. That's all.
But Charles, I'm often struck when you travel the world that the cities that you really love, they don't move all at the same speed. That they're cities that, you know, allow for fastness if that's what's needed, and meandering if that's what's needed. Mm-hmm. And often that's the intervention of seating, of public realm, of suddenly a little parklet that makes you want to sit down and have your sandwich, you know, a place you want to linger. Mm-hmm. So, Sophia, is that notion of the multi-speed city something that you think is one of the things that makes us love a place more than just live there?
I suppose so. I heard recently that somebody was reflecting that they find what they love when it feels and looks familiar. And I think this is a little bit back to your point, Charles, that there is something quite unique about the way that we experience place and space and what we look for when we want to find a sense of comfort and connection to the people around us. And there are very specific design choices and sensibilities no matter where you are. You could be in Tokyo and the beloved place is where you find a sense of calm, a sense of quiet, where you might hear a bird, where you might be able to hear the water, and that could be the same in San Francisco or Copenhagen, right? Wherever you go, you're looking for that same feeling.
And oddly, you get that here in Expo City. I think it's striking when you go outside, the number of shaded areas, the number of places where you can dwell, which maybe are not evident in all parts of the region, but here in this city, maybe it's again what Nadia, who was on our Women's Matters panel, was saying earlier about the notion of women being involved in that discussion, that those things were put on the agenda a little bit.
Well, speaking of involved in this discussion, do raise your hands if you want to get involved. Jonathan, I want to ask you a little bit about designing then with that kind of intentionality. If you're looking to be reactive to behaviours, or maybe to initiate a change in behaviour, whether it's in a residential setting or a shared space, do you have to look at data sets that you use and research? We spoke before and you were talking about reverting to sort of an academic rigor to drive some of that process. How do you actually work to make sure you're having that conversation before you even commence a project?
You know, I think it's important to believe, and I think it was even mentioned on the previous panel, is that getting out away from your desk and not just hypothesizing everything, you have to really understand how things are delivered, because not everything is practically solved on a computer or on a drawing pad. I really love about architecture and design is that essentially you hand over the building to the client and then the life starts. It becomes a canvas. I think by anchoring projects and places around the intrinsic human behaviors, which are familiar across cultures, but they're essentially back to the fundamentals, you know, needs for nature, you know, daylight, you know, what is it like waking up in the morning with a sunrise in the east or the west, and depending on how all those do. And if you can, as a practice, look at those elements in terms of the micro location that you're working on a project, whether it's an existing repurposing of a building and bringing that back to life, there's a certain sense of responsibility with that. We've been doing that in the region for quite some years now, and it's been unexpected, but it's made great results. So people have actually listened and contributed. But then we also need to be sensitive. We don't need to overdevelop it. We don't need to push it, because from a perspective of being based in the UAE for a long time, particularly in Dubai, this idea of layering, you know, when I travel to Asia, and not so much, but you see it in historical buildings in Europe, but when you look to Asia, this is sort of layering process in buildings, and this sort of, you can see the story of creation. I think that's become something important, particularly in new cities, where you can tell a bit of the past, but it's about finding people that want to delve in to discover it. So, you know, you look at it, it's either probably with you guys when you're obviously with Monaco, you look at the headline, but then you look at the content, and then you look at the narrative, and then you look at the quotes. It's about how deep each person wants to read, irrespective of whether it's architecture, place, city. It's really interesting to kind of get behind the psychology of it. And as you were saying, I actually feel that I draw more on my academic experience at the Bartlett when I was back in 2004-5
in London. It can't be that long ago.
Yeah, I'm aging very, very gracefully. The idea of that now for me, they threw me into the deep end. I've only been in the UK. My first trip was to go out to Asia. It was in Penang, in Malaysia, then on to Kuala Lumpur, and I was blown away. But it now starts to kind of resonate more with me now and my team to think, well, actually, we have a responsibility. And as a practice, if we're doing things, we want to do it for a relevance and purpose. It's not just driven by a commercial or even a brief from a client. We'll challenge that because it's a responsibility, but it's also an opportunity to contribute. I mean, it's a lasting element that you're putting invested time, energy, and often money into.
Andrew, I was going to actually ask you about, we've heard about blending, attempting to do it seamlessly, nature, data, but this critical idea of sort of storytelling, and I don't know if it's just journalists talking, but it's so important to have that coherent story. I mean, that's a smart point. Do we sometimes not spend enough time on crafting that narrative, the story of why? Because that's critical to carry people along if we're going to make meaningful progress on some of these really generational challenges, right?
Well, I hope this answers the question, because I think what's also fascinating about being here and having been in the region a little bit over the past year is how many architects and designers are beginning to look to the story of the past here to solve the problems of the future as well. So people knew how to keep buildings relatively cool before there was the world of air conditioners. They knew how to use a cross breeze. They knew how a shaded courtyard would add coolness at the heart of a home, the benefits of a tree hanging over a front door. And I think some of that storytelling, not just here, but in every country, needs to come back into the narrative, because when you look at the stories that people told, I'm looking at Nasra here because she knows this. This is one of our speakers from earlier today, working on amazing projects in Nairobi. And she's found that the solutions aren't from going to big companies. They're from going to people in communities who knew what was needed. That you needed to build a parklet. You needed to empower people to plant trees, to grow shade. They know the solutions, that many of those things are close to hand. So I think that this conversation is vital, because I think it backs into the conversation about climate change. It backs into the conversation about taking care of men, women, children who spend a lot of time outdoors or at home. And many of the solutions, as you were saying, Jonathan, you went to Sri Lanka, many of the things you needed were there on your doorstep.
No, exactly. That, I mean, it was so obvious, and it felt really irresponsible if we were forcing something. But it was something about also a bit of a passion to find out how it was constructed and bringing through those traditions. The greatest thing there was actually they were so familiar with Jeffrey Bauer, and actually the client was a distant connection to Jeffrey Bauer. So as soon as they heard that, they got so excited from the building contracting side, because they know what an impact he had done in terms of tropical modernism. So it was really interesting to see at a very, you know, sort of fundamental level, people's interest and the knowledge of actually doing something right can make a difference.
Sophia, you're beginning to, you're looking in the same direction with solutions?
Yeah, I actually was just thinking that this is maybe also the beauty of placemaking, back to the initial point that we started on, which is that this provides us a really unique platform to be able to just try something, test it, collect data, understand how it shifts maybe the user experience or the behaviors that we observe, and then we can scale up those solutions. I think a lot of people here in the audience are often thinking about the kind of economics behind some of these big, big projects. And if we want to have social impact, not only the economic return on investment, you know, we can start small and we actually can test, we can prototype, we can scale up based on what's working and what's not working.
Charles, I know you were eager to jump in there.
Yeah, I was just thinking, because we're using here some very big words, which are very important words, of course, community, etc., the sensory landscape of a place and all the senses. Place is often contested, and I think we should be aware of a distinction, which is between conviviality, which is the notion that we want to be together, and convivienza, which is a lovely Portuguese word, which basically says, look, convivienza, it's a bit like in a family. Yeah, I broadly like you, Sophia, but I'm just about to have a row with you. Now, space and place is contested a lot of the time, and great design is about needing to find ways of being able to address that, but also to establish the institutions that help us do that. One of the best institutions, as we know, of course, is great libraries, when they are great, because they're the most commonly used institutions. So I just think we need to be aware of that. And on the community point, I'll only just make one small point, is I believe community is often made up of hundreds of small micro experiences that may add up, and I may fall in love with you or the city or whatever else, but it's this micro stuff added up, which is all signaled by the way the design is perceived, which is why psychology, obviously we affect the city or the city affects us, just to have that awareness. And by the way, there are rarely psychologists in urban planning, just in passing.
Does anybody have a question? I see there's one over there. Shall I roam out? Have we got a mic holder, or shall I roam out myself?
I can go with the mic, Tom. I'll be the mic runner.
Okay, Andrew Tucker's on his way over. Do just introduce yourself so we know who's asking the question. But lovely to hear from our listeners here in the room.
Hi, everyone. My name is Mia. I'm working with the Climate Fresk. And I had a question I wanted to come back on social connections. So you talked about social connections and community. And for me, that's one of the main things that will drive change and climate action, because, yeah, we'll be able to be more satisfied with that kind of thing. And so I wanted to ask if in your work and in your, you know, in your professional work, when you work in cities and planning, are you ever asked to think about these things? And when you are, how do you implement that kind of, how do you foster, you know, that kind of connection, social connection, and that sense of community? Is it something that happens spontaneously? Are there things, are there kind of principles, building principles, planning principles that we can kind of unlock or use that can foster that kind of energy and sense of community?
Great question. Sophia, for some reason, as the anthropologist amongst us, perhaps you should go first on that one.
Well, social connection is something that we are often designing for, actually. And I think there are some mechanisms of change when it comes to bringing communities together, diverse, maybe socioeconomic communities or whatnot. And those mechanisms for us often come from actually designing for children. We found, and that's just one of many, many examples, but we have found in our projects where we do design for children that it brings many different communities together, because we can all agree on how we give our children a great start in life. So where we maybe place play infrastructure, or how we create routes or corridors of play along the way, these are kind of moments of cohesion that we find in the cities that we're working in.
Maybe just ask from our side. I mean, I mentioned very briefly about this global local idea, and I think where we've gone to work in a country or a city that we're not familiar with, we've put ourselves in there and tried to sort of visually and listen and see and smell how that city feels. So for us, we've gone in as a foreigner and it's very active. But then we've actually discussed with people from that city, that community. You can't forget that for them, it's passive. So when you bring those two together, when you're very active, you need to be aware, you're hypersensitive to what you're looking at. But when you're in there, you become quite passive and you just go the day-to-day routines. So I think if you find those balances in terms of architectural design and when we're working in places that we're not familiar with, it's been something that we've found interesting nuances to draw out and then express within the architecture of the interiors.
Well, I can't believe that time is almost against us. Well, I'll just ask for a final. Andrew is tasking people with delivering a call to action. What about a little provocation? Charles, you're a provocative character.
Am I a provocateur?
But just give us a really quick, one little provocation to take away. Is it
well,
about
how do we create
psychology
the conditions for people, organisations and cities to enable those to become makers, shapers, and co-creators of their evolving environment.
Sophia, can you match that for a soundbite?
No, I like this provocation. I think it's fantastic. How do we work across disciplines and sectors to really make the change that we actually want to see? Yeah, absolutely.
Well, that's pretty good, Jonathan. Can you do it 10 seconds?
To be an antagonist, I think you should always look at challenging. You shouldn't just take things at face value, and you should really enter into them and in a collective, collaborative way and shared knowledge, bring for good your skills.
It's called an architect, right? There's a reason behind that. Andrew, we've wound up with you. Give us a quick Monocle provocation.
Just finally, I think, as with this event, talk to people whose lives are different to yours. That should be your starting point.
Well, that's all for this edition of The Briefing. Do join us later. We've got more panels. You can see our little booth in the corner. Thanks to all the crew here. Thanks to our engineer, Sam, at the back of the room. Do stay tuned. More special episodes of The Briefing coming up. I'm Tom Edwards. Goodbye. Thanks for listening, everybody.